to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. Bull trout are native to Alberta's East Slope streams, but their once abundant population has dwindled to almost nothing. Now, Paul Vengard of the Alberta Conservation Association is monitoring a program to see if we can bring back the bull trout. And you might take it for granted that old people fall down. For the elderly, the simple fear of falling can seriously undermine their quality of life. That's why researcher Leslie Brown of the University of Lethbridge has taken up falling down. And West Nile virus, coming soon to a mosquito near you. Tim Lissick of Agriculture Canada has been watching the rapid dispersal of this germ across the continent. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. A century ago, bull trout inhabited almost every East Slope River that ran onto the prairies. But bull trout are easy to catch, and they eventually succumbed to the pressures of settlement, increased angling, and habitat loss. Now their numbers are so scarce, you will rarely find a bull trout except in very remote streams. To protect what's left, no harvest regulations have been enacted. Paul Vengard has been monitoring bull trout in the Kakwa River watershed for several years. Paul is the Regional Programs Manager for the Alberta Conservation Association at Peace River.
Today we just came back from an annual fish collection activity. We have an intensive program set up that measures the abundance of juvenile bull trout in the rearing areas of Lynx Creek, which is an important spawning tributary to the Kakwa River bull trout.
What did you find?
We found some interesting things. Compared to last year, the abundance of juvenile bull trout seemed to be on the increase relatively. We haven't looked at the data yet. And it does make sense because the annual enumerations of adult bull trout at the fish trap near the mouth of the tributary is on the increase as well. So as more adults are using the creek to spawn, it would imply that we would see a higher juvenile density along the way.
How are you actually going about capturing them so you can enumerate them?
We have a standardized site set up, and it's been inventoried at the same spot, the same way over the last 8 years or so. We set up block nets in a 300-meter section, and we use what's called a depletion removal technique where we, as fish are captured in the section, they're removed so they can't be counted twice, and there's some mathematics behind it where we can get a real accurate estimate from that site. From that, we have eight other sites where we just use single-pass electrofishing, and we can use a lot of correlations with that one base site, and we can infer abundance of these single passes relative to the exact population estimate from the one site.
So what sizes would they be? Would they be all sizes in year classes or what that you found today?
No, the majority of year classes that we capture in the rearing areas, particularly at this time of the year, all the adult bull trout have since exited the tributary. The size classes range from one-year-olds to three-year-olds, and in terms of length, they would be about 75 millimeters fork length to probably 250 millimeters fork length would be on the large size.
You've been doing this for 8 years. When you look at what it was like the first year and what you're seeing now, is it encouraging results or the other way?
The results are very encouraging. The adult enumerations at the trap were at an all-time high this year, and it could be hypothesized that we're starting to see the benefits of the catch-and-release regulations that were put on in 1995, and this is really encouraging. It took this long for the benefits of those regulation strategies to really show themselves. On the flip side, at the watershed level, when we first started our program down there, the watershed was very quiet. It was a nice sleepy watershed. You really, a truck driving by would really get your attention. And now we don't feel comfortable unless there's 50 trucks driving by a day at our camp. So the industrial activity is really on the increase in the watershed, and that's going to have some negative impacts on the bull trout populations down there. it's a real luxury for us to have this long-term baseline data set that we can use to monitor the effects of industrial encroachment on and just gauge the success of the whole variety of mitigative strategies that are applied to all these industrial activities.
With this increase in industrial activity, that's oil and gas, or is there forestry in there as well?
It's both oil and gas, seismic, forestry operations. Those are the three big operators in the area.
What impact would they have? Does it have to do with road building or stream crossings? What sorts of things would they do that would have a negative impact on bull trout?
Right now, stream crossings as a result of increased roading is a big issue. Quite often, stream crossings provide a unnatural point source for sedimentation to enter the streams, and that has a real negative effect on a whole variety of things, smothering eggs that are incubating and reducing food items that may grow and reside in the streams. And probably as importantly or more importantly, quite often roads are crossed over streams with culverts, and sometimes these culverts aren't installed properly, and when they're installed off the stream bed, they form what we call a hanging culvert, and fish aren't able to migrate through these things or navigate up through the culvert, and it fragments the habitat and it isolates pockets of populations throughout the stream, and in the long term setting, it can have a real negative effect on the population in the watershed.
Well, I guess one of the nice things is that you're dealing with an area that is just opening up as opposed to having to deal with the legacy of an older industry footprint. Are there things that are happening that you can actually deal with the industrial people before they go in and build something so that it's done better?
Yeah, we are quite wealthy in knowledge down in the watershed. We continually provide our information to industrial planners and fisheries managers, sustainable resource development, and they seem to be quite receptive in using our information to make appropriate land use decisions. Quite often, SRD will consult us on what we know about a particular stream and where the spawning areas are, and those are all incorporated into local land use planning processes.
What happens next?
What happens next is a good question. We're going to continue to monitor the bull trout populations in the watershed. The long-term baseline trend data is very important to maintain. Data sets are quite often just observations in time, but this one's a long-term observation, which is really important to gauge successes and measure impacts against them. In terms of other activities, we're going to expand our juvenile density program to gain a higher comfort level of the real abundance of juvenile bull trout at the reach level. We have some other programs that are going to go on down there. One additional one slated for this summer is going to look at the spawning frequency of bull trout, which is an important characteristic to appropriately manage bull trout.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you, Cheryl.
That was Paul Vengard, Programs Manager for the Northeast Region of the Alberta Conservation Association. Earlier this year, my mother, who is 75, tripped over a crack in the sidewalk and fell down. Her wrist and leg were sore for several days afterwards, and her eye black and blue for much longer. Fortunately, there were no broken bones, at least not this time. As people age, spills and falls take on greater meaning because of the potential for devastating consequences. Dr. Leslie Brown is a kinesiologist at the University of Lethbridge. With help from the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, she is studying falls.
Well, the problem is that older people fall down, and my work is trying to address why that is. There's a lot of statistics out there which indicate that after the age of 65, about 1 in 3 individuals will fall at least once a year. And what we know is that the consequences of a fall are much more devastating for the elderly than they are for younger people. What happens is individuals become institutionalized, they lose their independence, and eventually they can get sick and die. So what my research tries to understand and tries to explore is what is it that happens with the older population that makes them less able to perhaps detect and or recover from a possible fall episode.
What is it that you've done then in order to do this research?
My work looks at a kind of what I think to be a unique approach to addressing the problems of falls in the elderly, and I try and understand this issue of fear of falling. Fear of falling is actually more common than having an actual fall episode. We know that 1 in 3 people over the age of 65 will fall each year, but we also know that a great higher number of older adults actually do have a fear or an anxiety about the possibility that they're going to fall. I think about 60% of community-dwelling older adults are concerned that they're going to fall. And as you can imagine, this concern can actually interfere with their capacity to enjoy life and also to carry out activities of daily living.
So what will they do? Just stay at home?
Eventually, they start out becoming much more cautious, and as the caution becomes overwhelming, it can actually become detrimental, and they do stay at home. And when they stay at home, they're not exercising, and they're not being physically active, and that inactivity leads to disuse, problems associated with disuse, weakness, and, of course, the eventual inability to recover from a possible fall. So my research is trying to understand the sort of the early on phase, this initial point in time when they start to become more anxious. Because as you can imagine for yourself, when you are anxious or concerned that you're going to fall, for example, when you're out hiking or when you're walking on ice, you become much more rigid. And I'm trying to understand whether this rigidity is actually beneficial or detrimental to being able to control your balance.
What have you found out so far then?
Well, right now my work is focused on healthy older adults. So these are the 40% of the older adult age group who have not or who do not claim to have a fear of falling. So they're very comfortable and actually very physically active. And in order to answer the question, what I need to do is make them concerned about their balance. So to do that, I bring them into my research laboratory, and I put them in tenuous situations that will give them some concern.
What would be a tenuous situation?
Well, a tenuous situation in the laboratory is asking them to stand on the edge of an elevated platform. And I do have a hydraulic lift, which comes up about 6 feet off the ground, and they stand on the edge of the platform. I also have a narrow walkway, much like a balance beam, and they walk along the balance beam. And as you can imagine, that manipulation of environment, the constraints imposed by the environment, presents a possibility that not just that they could fall, but if they fall, they could hurt themselves. And the assumption is that that is analogous to what happens when somebody's concerned that they're going to fall. They're not just concerned they're going to fall, but they're concerned that the fall could cause some injury and that the injury could be detrimental to their quality of life.
Have you lost anybody yet?
We haven't lost anybody at all. We do have definite precautionary measures in place. But what we have found is that indeed the environmental manipulation that we impose does make people more concerned, and it does make them more anxious. And that anxiety is manifest in the way that they control their balance. They become much more rigid and they become much more stiff. Now, interestingly, when we extrapolate those changes across to activities of daily living, for example, being able to negotiate an unexpected obstacle, what we find is that people are much better, which implies that this some level of anxiety or some level of concern is actually a beneficial consequence. But I must caution that these people are healthy older adults. These are the minority of the group. These are the 40% who remain active. My current research is now going to look at the other population, you know, the remaining 60% who already have this concern that they're going to fall. And we're going to try and understand if the same results emerge in this group.
How will you go about testing that?
Well, the first thing that we have to do is that we have to recruit individuals who are concerned about their balance. So we need to get out into the community and we need to start recruiting, asking people about their balance, and then we rate their level of fear of falling based on some validated questionnaires. And then based on their responses to that, we'll invite them into the laboratory for some similar testing, but probably not as intensive.
I can see them resisting getting up on a balance beam.
Yes, we certainly wouldn't have them go on the narrow walkway, but we do have a little bit wider walkway as well. So,
once you get through the research program, how will you use these results? Where do you think this is all leading?
I think that this work is actually really unique because what it allows us to explore and really understand is the very large contribution that our concerns and our feelings have in our ability to move. So in the long run, in the long term, I think this work helps us to understand how cognitive factors, in this case, fear falling, and can contribute and how important they are in trying to rehabilitate from a fall episode. For example, if somebody has a fall and breaks a hip, the first thing that you want to do is rehabilitate the injury, and that injury is in the form of a broken hip. But what also needs to be rehabilitated is the consequences, the cognitive consequences, the fear and the anxiety, because we know that that fear and anxiety can actually also have an effect on the way that and how well they can move.
Well, I'm just thinking of my own situation with, you know, my mom's still at home, and you always say, now be careful, don't fall. And I'm now having listened to what you're working on, it's almost as though you shouldn't say those sorts of things.
Right. It's kind of a catch-22, actually. When you bring somebody's attention towards their balance, be careful, don't fall, it can be good. But at the same time, it can be bad because they would, you know, stiffen up, et cetera, and depending on their ability to control their balance, control their own movements, it's hard to say at this point in time.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how things work out. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I was speaking with Dr. Leslie Brown, a kinesiologist at the University of Lethbridge. Her research is supported by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. Unheard of in North America until 3 years ago, West Nile virus is now front page news. The germ first made its presence known when many dead birds and a handful of human mortalities in New York were attributed to the foreign virus. Dr. Tim Lissick is a specialist in medical veterinary entomology with Agriculture Canada at the Lethbridge Research Station. He's been watching with keen interest the rapid spread of West Nile virus.
Yeah, basically it was introduced in New York in 1999, spread to some of the neighboring states in 2000, and then made a real expansion up through most of the Midwestern states up to the Mississippi in 2001, and now it's pretty much covered most of the U.S. It made its way into Canada pretty early on in southern Ontario, and it's now been reported basically from Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, Quebec, and Nova Scotia.
Why is it moving so quickly?
The virus has quite a broad host range. It infects a number of bird species, and including things like crows, where it's causing lots of mortality, blue jays, and other types of waterfowl, geese, and basically, the virus has a very long persistence in the bird hosts, and as they migrate south. North and south for the winter, and east and west, some of the species migrate. They basically move the virus out into new areas. And it's probably a limited amount of mosquito dispersal, but it's probably mostly for a geographic pattern that big. It's probably mostly being carried by its by the avian hosts.
How does that compare to other viruses that have come from foreign countries?
This one's different. We've only really had a couple of other viruses that have moved from, that have come from foreign countries, and those were historic. And I guess yellow fever made its way into the United States, into the Western Hemisphere, as well as dengue fever. But I think those two actually were originated from Africa and actually were introduced by human movements in the 15, 16, 1700s, which you can read as slave trade, basically. So you have a lot of human movement having brought them in and then the diseases became established. What's unique about those viruses is that they're really a fairly simple transmission system, mosquito to human, and that's it. And they have very limited involvement of wildlife or other source hosts, at least in North America. There are monkeys that are involved in with yellow fever in South America and Africa. With West Nile, it's really the first major encephalitis that has crossed the Atlantic, made its way into North America, and really, I think its establishment, it's going to be here, and it's going to be here to stay. We're not going to be able to get rid of it because it has such a broad host range. It's found in something like 40 species of mosquitoes can transmit it, and a huge number of wildlife hosts are going to be will be able to support it. So we have this huge, naive, wild set of wildlife populations that the virus gets into and starts developing.
When you look at things like malaria, they are limited by the climate here because they seem to stick with warmer climates. What about this one?
With this disease, I don't think you're going to see so much climatic limitation with it. With malaria, there are certain temperature thresholds that the parasite won't develop in the mosquito once temperatures get below those. I think with this disease, it's got, again, such a huge range in the eastern hemisphere, basically from Africa all the way up to Volgograd in the Soviet Union. Yeah, there was an outbreak in Volgograd a couple of years ago. I don't think temperature is going to be a limiting factor for this one.
Well, it seems rather odd that we've gone all these thousands of years without having it over here on the continent, and now all of a sudden it appears. What do you think accounts for that?
I don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of speculation on how it made its way over here. There are a number of viruses that do persist in the old world that haven't made their way over here. Japanese encephalitis, there's a number from Australia. I think with West Nile, some of the ways that it's been suggested it was introduced was in a mosquito that hitchhiked a ride on an airplane. Animals that were imported either legally or illegally into the U.S. Or just a person brought it over there and infected local mosquitoes. Birds that had been blown off course, although that's a hell of a long way to get blown off course from the middle of Africa to New York City. And bioterrorism has been suspected, but I guess I remember listening to one person talk about potential for bioterrorism, and West Nile is relatively a benign disease, and I think if bioterrorists were going to use something, they'd probably use something a lot more serious.
When you say it's relatively benign, what would be the effects?
The effects of West Nile? They vary. Most people that are actually infected with the disease probably would never show clinical symptoms. You might get a mild headache or something like that, and it would go away, and you wouldn't even know you picked it up. You will get more serious headache, nausea, fatigue, general flu-like symptoms. In about, I actually forget what the number of cases, it's like 1-2% of people that have been infected will actually show clinical cases, or actually show clinical disease. And of that, I think it's in the U.S. now, it's roughly running around, of the ones that show clinical, you're looking at mortality in about 5-10% of them. So, the symptoms can range from absolutely nothing to death.
Is it something that once a person does become infected, or an animal, that you develop some sort of resistance to it afterwards so it doesn't...
Yeah, you do. I think you do develop immunity. I mean, people are working on developing West Nile vaccines, and with most viral diseases you can develop immunity, and immunity tends to be quite long-lasting. And I would expect it to be the same in this case. Horses are actually where I think the vaccines are being initially developed for. In horses, the fatality rate runs around 40% to 50% of horses that start showing clinical signs. So it's a much more serious disease in them than it is in humans.
What can we learn from the countries where it originated from, where obviously there would be a natural resistance that has evolved over time?
Well, from my standpoint, the thing that we learn the most is basically a bit about transmission patterns, particularly the types of mosquitoes that vector it. And I think what the other thing we've learned is that it really is a very complex disease in its native range.
What are you looking at in terms of research on this?
We'd like to get a research program going on it. Basically, I think what needs to be done is really to identify what are the potential vectors for West Nile. What mosquitoes can actually support the disease? What's the host range of those mosquitoes? Do they include birds alone or birds and humans, birds, horses, and humans? Where are those mosquitoes coming from? And I guess where are they going? Because that's where they're going to take the virus with them. So those would really be the major things, I think, to initially worry about right now, is essentially just primarily vector identification and trying to look at what species are most likely to be transmitting the disease.
So I guess the bottom line is West Nile virus is here to stay and we have to learn to live with it.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. We have a number of other viruses that are present. Things like Western equine encephalitis in particular used to be quite abundant in Western Canada. I suspect what will happen in the future is that West Nile virus will taper out as an issue. I think the biggest concerns are right now, now that we have a basically naive population facing this virus, the interesting stuff will be happening early on, and over time it will fade away.
It hasn't been identified in Alberta yet, but do you expect to see it soon?
Yeah, I expect it next year. I was actually expecting it this year, but the trouble with statements like it not being identified as Alberta in Alberta is that we just really don't have any idea how hard anybody's looking for it. I really don't know how many dead crows have been sent in for diagnostics or whatever. So we don't know if the disease is not here. I mean, it's been collected through quite a broad range in Saskatchewan. I'd be surprised if it wasn't here right now. And I think we will get definite evidence of it here next year.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Tim Lisick. He's a specialist in medical veterinary entomology with Agriculture Canada at the Lethbridge Research Station. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. You can download past programs from our website at innovationalberta.com. And while you're visiting the Innovation Alberta website, subscribe to our weekly online newsletter. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the University of Lethbridge, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Alberta Ingenuity Fund, Alberta Research Council, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Crocher.